afternoon. It's not good when you start out with oops. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that's a
it's a little crazy in here.
Oops.
Headphones not working.
I know. We have cords everywhere. I think it was a radio station or something. Welcome to another episode. It is always an episode, isn't it, of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cunliffe. And we have a sponsor this hour. It's Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer up on Twin View Boulevard, 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They're everything John Deere, and let me tell you, folks, it's going to get busy. Sun's coming out, grass is growing, and you better get your stuff ready to go. Get in and get it serviced, get it tuned up, get new blades, and get ready to cut some grass. Also, if you're looking for a new tractor or a trade-in on an old one, go up and see them. They've got a great inventory right now. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. They can take care of all your John Deere needs. They've got great financing. I think they still have 0% available for tractors right now. So go up and see them or catch them on the interweb at www.papemachinery.com.
We're going to have Bill's lips removed. I wanted to take him in for the surgery.
I wanted to be concise.
Yeah, you're concise. All right. Go to timeout. We need like a hockey, you know, like in hockey. Put him in the penalty box.
Penalty box?
Go to the box.
You'd be in there already. There would be room for me.
That's true. I blundered at the beginning. I got my blunder out of the way early. Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope that you were making use of the archives, actually, at wethepeopleradio.us. We joke around a lot, but not really. One of the things on there, we do tons of shows on marijuana. The tab at the top of the page says, or the side, whatever, however you're looking at it, says pot. So pretty easy to find. And on that page, you will find a lot of resources. Bunches of shows, but a lot of resources. And all of our archived shows, they have they're commercial free. They're free to listen to. It's an MP3 file. You can download it. It's not there's no copywriting. You don't have to worry about it. You can share it with friends. You can burn it on CDs and sell it for a fundraiser. We don't care. We just want you to use the information. And there's not a day goes by that I don't speak with somebody who is impacted by the whole cannabis deal one way or the other, or has questions about it, and they don't really know what's going on with it. They don't have the information. So people are not really able to fight back adequately or speak out adequately because they are uninformed. And I don't mean that in a mean way. If that's not something that's in your world, you're thinking, well, I don't need to know that. But
yeah, and then
you
usually
do.
Yeah, and by the time that you figure it out, it's almost too late.
Yeah. So that's Kathy, by the way.
Hi.
The voice of Kathy, because that's what happened last time. They thought we were the same person. I was just like ventriloquisting myself. This like super low voice. It's kind of hard to miss, but okay. And then we have Officer Joe
She's
with us this
voice
morning
like
as well.
Merman.
Who's going to be talking about marijuana for vets and why we shouldn't do it?
Yes, with our guest. So just having said that, I really, really hope you make use of these programs that just have incredible experts. So our guest today is Dr. Bertha Madras, and she is the director at the Laboratory of Addiction Neurobiology. Maybe I should someone else read this. Finally had my cataracts done, and now my mouth won't work. What the heck?
Oh, Aaron, I have faith in you.
Oh, goodness, I'm looking through these stupid reading glasses. So let's see. She is a professor of psychobiology at Harvard Medical School, based in McLean Hospital and cross-appointed at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Her research focuses on neurobiology, imaging, and medications developed for neuropsychiatric disorders. Seems like a good topic that we keep hearing about all the time and that they lie about all the time. In public policy, she was the deputy director for demand reduction in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy and a presidential appointment confirmed unanimously by the U.S. Senate. So Dr. Madras is not somebody who's just, you know, giving her opinion and all of that. She she knows stuff. She recently served as a panelist at the Vatican Pontifical Academy of Sciences and in 2017 was appointed as one of six members of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. In service to the public, she developed a museum exhibit and CD licensed by Disney, interestingly enough, with the Museum of Science in Boston. She's the recipient of an NIH Merit Award, NIDA Public Service Award, and others. And so we've got more, but I'm not going to read all that because I would like her to tell us about it. But just so people understand, we are really, really endeavoring to bring you the top people that are working on this to give you the very best information so you can make informed decisions.
And current information.
That too. Speeding forward from the 1960s when THC was 2%. Yeah, fast forward. So where would we like to start today, Dr. Madras?
Oh, good afternoon.
Yes.
We can start wherever you'd like because there are so many topics to be covered that are crucial for public information. So you fire away and let's begin.
Dr. Madras, this is Officer Joe. First of all, I want to thank you so much for coming to this show and addressing our national audience. Locally here in California, we are now seeing the dispensaries doing their PSA and giving away free marijuana to vets, saying it is for PTSD. They're very careful about not actually doing a recommendation, something which they could be held liable for civilly. But they make it as a part of their package. So when they give it away, they say, we're giving away marijuana free to veterans with PTSD. And then they have, of course, the anecdotal evidence that the veterans are saying that it actually helps them. And I know I had written to you and asked you to perhaps talk to us about how effective marijuana is for PTSD and if it, in fact, causes more harm than good.
Well, that's a great question. The really good clinical trials haven't been done, but there have been a number of studies that are reported that show that, in fact, marijuana is not a great and effective treatment for PTSD, other than the self-reports of individuals. I never discount those. But if the data, if the statistics say that overall it's not effective, then one has to base your opinion on the overall data. The other thing that the data say is that marijuana can make PTSD worse, not better, in a number of people who have tried it for this purpose. So overall, I would say that anyone who recommends it for PTSD, and especially the vulnerable veterans in our nation who've been through a lot of challenges in their lives and have had a lot to deal with, this probably is not a drug that I would recommend for PTSD based on what is published now in the literature.
So my study of it, Dr. Madras, and you can comment on this, because from what I understand, it actually, in veterans with PTSD, it can increase suicidality. Is that your understanding?
Well, there is some evidence that it does increase suicidality, not only in veterans, but in young people as well. In Colorado... We've seen an increase in suicidality amongst youth, and the drug that's most often found on board with these children who've completed a suicide or have discussed suicide, the drug that's most often found is marijuana. So there is an overlap between the two. We don't understand the mechanism, but we certainly have the correlation between the two. And from my purposes, from my perspective, if there's a correlation, that's enough of a signal to stay away from a drug that could make your psychological state a lot worse.
So in follow-on to that, according to my research, again, marijuana use is linked to aggressive behavior and domestic violence and can cause or exacerbate psychosis or produce paranoia, all of which can lead to violence and homicide. And I've tracked over, something like 1,000 cases, recent cases of either serial murderers or people that had PTSD that then went on to have violent episodes. Have you found in your research any correlation of that at all?
Well, there is more and more evidence linking marijuana to violence. And it's something that people have dismissed for years because the user consistently reports that marijuana mellows them out, makes them feel better. But the literature, the scientific literature on the association between marijuana and violence is growing. And I think there are two reasons for it. One is that the very potent forms of marijuana could, in fact, be related to an increased level of violence. And number two is that people who are in withdrawal seem to have a greater tendency to violence. So both of these, you know, higher potency or in withdrawal, both of these could be very important factors in promoting violence. Anecdotally, there are many cases in the media, which occasionally I do not trust at all, but for people who've been involved in very high-profile cases of fighting with police or, in fact, in mass murders, there has been reasonably good reports that they were heavy marijuana users. You know, I think of the Boston bomber during the Boston Marathon in, I believe it was 2013. They were both heavy marijuana users, the brothers who developed the bombs and exploded them in innocent people who were either bystanders or running. So we see that in a number of other cases in which there is mass murders, that the kids who are involved in these appear to have been heavy marijuana users. The problem is that I would love to see their data. I would love to see their blood levels or urine levels, either post-mortem or right after the episode, to verify it, but I don't have access to their data, so that I would have to just say that I'm claiming reports from the media rather than from a scientific document that would say, yes, these were heavy marijuana users. They're just anecdotal reports that have been published by the media.
There are so many, though, it's pretty hard to say that that's not a factor. We have posted on our website, there's a little link there that says shooters, terrorists, and mass killers who used marijuana. And when you click on that, it pulls up a very long list with the links to the stories where that was set. So it isn't just a list like, oh, we're just claiming everybody who did something bad was involved with this. It shows the links to all the stories. But it goes way back. This just didn't happen in the last 5 years. I mean, this is stretching out now for decades.
And Dr. Madras, for you,
it's been stretching out for a very long time, and it's very worrisome because, especially with young people, I think that the loss of judgment that one has under the influence of marijuana, combined with the fact that if they're in withdrawal or they can't access or they don't have money to maintain the high levels that they're used to, then it really can incur violence. Plus, the fact that marijuana can also induce psychosis in vulnerable people, especially young people. And if they're in a state of psychosis, part of the spectrum of effects, part of the spectrum of the characteristics of psychosis is paranoia. it's believing that people are against you, that people are out to get you, that the CIA is spying on you, that people are broadcasting through your teeth, others, and all these forms that paranoia can take may be exaggerated or may be in fact induced by marijuana, because there's no question that there is a very strong association between marijuana use and psychosis. And we're reaching the point where we have at least 6 bullet points of what is causal as opposed to what is association. And there are at least 5 of those 6 indicators that suggest that marijuana is in fact causal. It's not just a coincidental association with psychosis.
Dr. Madras, when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you about drug interactions.
Not in all cases, not in the majority, but in specific cases of individuals, it can take the form of violence or can be expressed as a form of violence.
And I think that's something that the public needs to become very, very aware of for their own kids, for you know, for anybody that they where they're making decisions on the accessibility of this and the effects it may have. We've got to come right back. We've got a break. Our guest is Dr. Bertha Madras. She is a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Science going on here.
No.
Talking to Dr. Bertha Madras from the Harvard Medical School. She's a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry. And Officer Joe had a question.
So, Dr. Madras, as a practicing psychiatrist, one of the things I'm always concerned for you as healthcare professionals is the harmful drug and medicine interactions with marijuana. And I know that from what I understand, that it can, if you're treating a patient, for example, who has PTSD, or a young patient who a parent has brought in for psychotherapy, and medication is prescribed to that patient, that there are, it can change how sedatives react in the body, how Anabuse can react in the body, Prozac, and some other drugs. Could you discuss any of those interactions? Have they ever come up in your practice?
I do not practice. I have to preface that. I'm a basic neuroscientist by training, so that everything that I relate to you is based on my knowledge of the literature and my own research, my own laboratory research, as well as research in public policy. The important thing to remember is there are 2 things to be afraid of in terms of marijuana interactions with drugs. One is that cannabidiol, which is found in most marijuana preparations, interferes with the P450 metabolic system. So that if medications are given that use the system for metabolism, the medication dose may be completely inaccurate and may be much higher if cannabidiol is present to block the metabolism of prescribed medications. That's one important issue. The second important issue is that certain symptoms, certain psychiatric symptoms, which include depression, anxiety, stress, suicidality, treatment for opioid use disorder. All of these can be derailed by the introduction of marijuana into the system, because marijuana can, in fact, increase symptoms of depression, increase anxiety, increase stress. It can interfere with treatment for opioid use disorder. There's very interesting literature on that. And it can also interfere with treatment for other substance use disorders. So that it's important to recognize that for a whole range of issues, the co-use of legitimate pharmaceuticals with marijuana is not a wise idea, due to metabolic interactions as well as marijuana worsening psychiatric symptoms.
And
of course, I left out psychosis, which should be the number one issue.
Dr. Madras, is there any difference between, whether they smoke it or eat it, or, you know, is there any distinction in your research that you're finding based on how people are interacting with this?
Yes, it's fascinating because in emergency department mentions, smoking and especially high doses of marijuana appear to be associated with an increasing prevalence of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which is uncontrollable vomiting that can be so unpleasant that the person is really just wants to crawl out of their skin. They just have nonstop vomiting. Some of them absolutely refuse to accept the fact that this vomiting is due to marijuana. But lo and behold, if you stop the marijuana, the vomiting disappears. And smoking is the route of administration that's most likely to lead to it. The edibles, the gummy bears, the brownies, the drinks, they appear to be more associated with emergency department mentions of psychosis. So now that doesn't mean that smoking will not precipitate a psychotic reaction. It does not mean that eating gummy bears will avoid hyperemesis syndrome, but it does mean that there's a higher prevalence of people who smoke, who have uncontrolled vomiting. There's a higher prevalence of people who eat marijuana through, edibles that have a higher prevalence of psychosis. But there seems to be a little bit of a distinction. We'd love to see more research on it to see if that shakes out with hundreds of thousands of people rather than a few hundred or a few thousand.
So do you think so there's a whole school of thought that, well, if we just legalized it nationwide, we took it off the schedule as a drug, and we, allowed it to be, regulated by the government, blah, blah, blah. And they've done a great job in California regulating it so far. I just want to point that out.
And get FDA approval.
Oh, and get FDA approval. Can you see any path forward on that makes any sense?
Zero.
Yay.
How's that for a definitive answer?
I believe we call that epic fail.
And this is an epic fail. So let's take a look at some of the promises made. The promises made is that if you legalize, you will be able to regulate it. We'll get rid of the illegal market.
Yeah, that's
we'll
worked out well here.
A windfall of taxes. And we will prevent young people from having access to it.
Right.
Epic fail on every one of these. In fact, in California, the illegal market is now bigger than the legal market, and it's grown bigger than ever before because there are more users.
Yeah.
Because there isn't as much stigma associated with using it. It's legal after all. So we have a lot more users. because of the higher potency that the legal market brought in, we have a lot more people with cannabis or marijuana use disorder, call it addiction, call it whatever politically correct name there is for it currently, but there are more people addicted to it. There is more market share for it in the illegal market. The Chinese have moved in to support illegal production. The tax windfalls are nowhere where they were predicted, and more young people are using than ever before, and more are using daily, which is an incredibly high risk for them. So in every possible way, legalization is a grand fail. Now, let's talk about medicalization. Right now, the evidence for cannabis as an effective medicine is on extremely shaky ground other than self-reports. All the so-called meta-analysis, where you take into account all the literature that's been published in every domain, and don't talk about Sativex or Marinol or any of these purified products. Let's talk about what's out in the market in dispensaries. There is absolutely very, very, very little or zero evidence that cannabis is an effective treatment for Parkinson's, for Alzheimer's,
Cancer.
Even for pain, for anxiety, for stress, for sleep disorders. You name it, the evidence is so thin. And if the FDA were to approve it, what would they approve? A plant with 20%, 30%, shatters and dabs with 90%, high THC, low CBD, high CBD, lower THC, a plant that has herbicide contamination, pesticide contamination, what would the FDA approve? Would they require, and they would, a dose response for every single medical indication that the states have so dramatically misused? For example, Illinois has 40 medical indications. I believe New Jersey has a very high number. Not one of them, not one has gone through any type of FDA process on dose response, on purity, on metabolism, effective dose. None of them. Indications, contraindications, side effect profile for different doses, and objective measures of positive outcomes. Just as an excess, how could the FDA possibly approve a substance of unknown purity, unknown strength, unknown actions and reactions and side effects for 40 diseases? The whole thing was created out of whole cloth. Many of the states that list these indications, including some that say for anything that the patient says is working to help them, it's just science fiction. It's not science.
Yeah,
the
no.
FDA would be derelict if they ever, ever tried to say that marijuana is now a effective medicine.
Well, and don't you think in reality the dealers or whatever you want to call them, they really don't want it FDA approved, because then they lose all control over their products?
Well, in reality, there are two reasons that they don't want FDA approval. Number one is that the cost would go sky high, because it takes a lot of money to do these studies. The FDA would then begin to really regulate it, and the regulatory oversight is what creates such high costs in pharmaceuticals. And third, they don't want the FDA
Right.
To show evidence that it doesn't work.
Right. 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 Exactly.
Well, also, I don't know how, you know, as long as it's being sold in these private co-ops, how they could ever regulate potency, quality.
They can't.
All those things. I mean, if you're gonna approve it, then all of that would have to be under pretty tight scrutiny, so that if somebody did go in there for a prescription, that they got exactly what was prescribed. And I don't see any way they can do that with the quality of the product that they're selling right now. I mean, you walk in and talk to a 18-year-old herbologist, and he's going to tell you how
butt tender.
Butt tender. He's the expert you're going to go to on your physical problem. I don't know how that would work.
And he would be practicing medicine without a license.
Yeah.
Oopsie.
Or without a pharmacy license.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they don't, of course they don't want the FDA involved. Of course, you know, when people spent, there were three billionaires that catalyzed this, what I call this marijuana mess on our country. These three billionaires spent over $100 million to promote medical and legal marijuana state by state. They could have taken that money and given it to people for clinical trials, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Because if they had done that, it would have been a benign and I think a judicious and conscientious way to spend money. But they didn't. They wanted to do an end run around the FDA, and the way you do an end run around the FDA is you get a ballot initiative, you get ads, you cozy up to the media. The media are really at fault here.
Yeah.
You get people to believe that this is a medicine, and therefore they're going to vote it as a medicine, which is not the way our nation has protected the public from phony products for dozens and dozens of years. But they did an end run around the FDA, and now we have voted a medicine. Can you imagine doing the same for a cancer therapy, which we did once in our history with Laetril? Can you imagine doing that for an antibiotic or a vaccine?
Cancer medication.
And growing it in your backyard.
Yeah, and then you
and
can
growing
grow
it in your backyard.
Yeah.
Well, it's
always amazed me that you hear these stories about these, you know, diet pills and different things that hit the market, and there's adverse reaction to it, and boy, they step right up and they get that jerked off the market, and it's gone. But they don't do that with marijuana, and you know they're getting reports of adverse reactions, and yet they don't touch it.
We have to take a quick break since I'm the official fun killer this hour. So the official fun killer says, time for break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Bertha Madras. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can...
Who is it?
Stop using pot. Oh, sorry.
So, Dr. Madras, we're back at We the People Radio.
Wonderful.
And I wanted you to know that we're taking action. We're producing. We're going to start producing a national PSA campaign that all of our prevention groups will be able to take these PSAs, use them in social media, any radio station that wants them. They're going to be done for free. And today, you are going to get to hear the first one. And I hope that our engineer is ready for us. Engineer, let's hear that PSA.
In that marijuana helps PTSD. This is Navy carrier pilot call sign 6 with a message to veterans. Local marijuana hucksters are offering free samples to veterans claiming that marijuana helps PTSD. These claims are not supported by legitimate medical studies, the VA or the FDA. Will you join me to protect our youth and our country from psychosis-inducing high-potency THC use? For the truth, please visit the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis at www.IndiaAlphaSierraIndiaCharlie1.org. Thank you.
So, Dr. Madras, coming back to the American Psychiatric Association, I note that they do not endorse cannabis. And I also note that this is very interesting. There hasn't been one medication ever in time that's ever been smoked. So we don't have medicines out there that are smoked. That's just not a route of administration for legitimate medicine.
Yeah, you go to the pharmacy and they give you a book of matches.
And the other thing that's interesting.
We still have books of matches?
The paraphernalia.
Yeah, yeah. There's a book of matches and a little pipe.
You need to consult with the pharmacist on how to light the matches?
Dr. Madras, I had the opportunity the other day to listen to Sir Robin Murray, a researcher that you probably know over in England, that talked about the difference between what's going on in Europe and why Amsterdam and Sweden and some of these other very liberal jurisdictions over there that used to be able to go and smoke cannabis, that they're pulling back from that because of all the problems. And would you like
to... And so is Holland.
Yeah, and so is Holland, yes. If you'd like to talk about that at all, I'm certainly interested.
Well, it's very interesting because what was prevalent in the 1960s and 70s is certainly not what we have now on the market. Because of legalization, because of normalization, we have created an entire industry that never existed before. The Mexican cartels, the family grows, never were really focused on developing high potency, high delivery methods for marijuana. Now, because there's commercialization, there's money to invest in creating new products, in creating products that are very susceptible, that are very attractive for young people, and, of course, the extremely high-potency products, which are gaining more and more of a market share. As these new products come on the market, there's increasing evidence that high-potency marijuana confers even a greater risk than the earlier versions, the older forms of marijuana. The progression to addiction is faster. The number of people using who become addicted is higher. The incidence of psychosis is higher. There are so many consequences to the use of potent marijuana that are just beginning to emerge because a lot of the biomedical literature has to catch up with this. A lot of the statements that were made in earlier publications about the association with psychosis are obsolete now because the high potency is just conferring a much greater risk. With young people, high potency also is associated with greater incidences of a greater risk, I should say, of psychiatric problems such as depression, anxiety. It's associated with higher levels of addiction to other drugs as well. And as I said, more rapid progression to becoming addicted. So in every possible way, these newly potent forms of marijuana, which have been cropping up in Europe as well as in the United States, are setting off alarm bells in Europe. I'm going to be in Sweden, in fact, in about a month or so, to discuss at many levels what the consequences are that we know now of high-potency marijuana and why, unfortunately, in this country, every attempt to limit the potency of marijuana has been derailed by the industry.
Hmm.
Why? Because the more potent, the more addiction, the more customers, the more profit.
Exactly.
Dr. Madras, are there any safe levels of THC in the body? Because here in California, when you go into a store and you see their gummies, they're saying that they are, and I don't know how they're testing their potency in any fashion whatsoever, but, and we know from Anresco Labs here, which is our major cannabis testing lab, they did 1,000 samples of NorCal in Northern California. And of those 1,000 samples that they did, over 80% of them were adulterated with something that was harmful to the human body. But going back to my original question, are there any safe levels of THC? And California, you're getting a dosage of 10 milligrams. But we know, through the literature and through reports from people like Dr. Finn, that his emergency room patients are talking about they're coming in with 5,000 milligrams of THC on board.
Yeah.
So could you address any of that?
And Dr. Libby Stute as well in Colorado is showing the same thing. People are using amounts that are beyond anything any of us ever imagined could be used. They're not safe. So what is the answer to the question, are there safe doses? I think the most important guidance of all is that if a dose produces intoxication, it de facto is not safe, whether it's a 3% THC or a 90% THC. Intoxication as a state of mind is an unsafe dose. But we also have to take into consideration that as the dose increases, the dose of THC, which is the major psychoactive component of marijuana, as the dose increases, the consequences get greater and greater. But if you're taking enough to become intoxicated, to become high, it means that you're compromised in terms of your ability to think, to judge, to drive a car, to engage in any kind of function that requires your brain to be working clearly. You know, let alone to operate a nuclear power plant, let alone to
operate a brain surgeon.
How about operating a train?
Or flying an airplane, a commercial airliner. So I think the guidance should be that a person who's intoxicated de facto has taken a dose that is unsafe. Now, people do develop tolerance to marijuana, which means that they need higher and higher potencies or more doses to get the same effect. In fact, marijuana produces tolerance very rapidly. So some people at 10 milligrams may not be intoxicated because they're already tolerant. They've already become, their brains are so used to it that in order to develop an intoxicating amount, they have to get more THC into their system. So we have to recognize that. It all depends on the individual and what they're used to. I've heard of a case in Colorado of a young man who ate a brownie that was handed to him free by one of these dispensaries, and he became psychotic and jumped out of a window because that was his first exposure.
Right. Wow.
And so we have those cases that are very alarming because people who are not tolerant, who are not used to it, have very, very robust reactions that you only get at very high doses in people that are tolerant. So it's not a simple answer. I think empirically it's what makes your brain dysfunctional that's considered an unsafe dose.
Recently, I attended a training that was put on by our HR department, and one of the topics was drug-free workplace. We have a a fairly difficult time hiring people that can pass a drug test. But what they said they were running into was if people are marijuana users and they know they're going to be tested, there's products out there that they can take right before the test that will they mask the marijuana in their system, but they also confuse the test to where it comes back inconclusive. Can you speak about that? I don't know, you know, if they come back with an inconclusive drug test, in the eyes of our department, they're not hireable for, I think, 6 months. They have to take it again. But I think people are under the impression that, hey, I'm going to get drug tested. I'll just drink some of this stuff, and then I'll pass my drug test. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, to be frank, I haven't heard of this way to circumvent a positive drug test, so I don't know what the mechanism is. But I can't say inconclusive would give me cause to be concerned, especially in safety-sensitive jobs. And the other way to circumvent this is to say that if we do hire you, you will be subject to random testing, not for cause, but just randomly.
Right.
And that could give you a very good awareness of whether or not that person is a habitual user or not. The military's having the same problem, of course.
Sure.
And they've had it for a number of years now in terms of recruiting. They're finding that young people who in the past were they had plenty of eligible candidates. They now are having a hard time because they're physically unfit and they are drug users. And the problem is with looming concerns about wars with China, with other nations, I don't think that this is a direction that our country wants to go in, especially for youth and especially for pregnant women and the elderly. I can go on and on.
There's
so many subpopulations that are really at very high risk of using.
Well, it in the past, before this became such a huge issue in our society, if a inconclusive test came back, it was deemed you passed the test. You didn't come back positive, and that's all they were looking for. Now they have included inconclusive in the as a same rating as a positive test, pretty much. You can't be hired with an inconclusive test. So I just want people out there to realize if their local bud tender, and I guess they sell these products right there at these pot shops,
I wasn't paying attention. And the news is going to cut us off. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio.